Hello and welcome to The Blockchain and Us, where pioneers and thought leaders talk about their journey in blockchain technology, crypto assets, and the token economy. And I'm your host, Manuel Staggers. This episode has support from no official sponsor, but from my very own The Blockchain and Us newsletter. Get an email from me every 2 weeks with a very short summary of new podcast episodes so you can immediately pick those interviews you'd like to listen to. To stay up to date, just visit www.theblockchainandus.com and sign up today. My guest today is Ryan Jesperson. Ryan is the president of the Tezos Foundation, and before he was the chief operating officer at Divi, a fintech company. Prior to his work at Divi, Ryan was an executive turnaround specialist and tech entrepreneur in the healthcare industry, and he helped launch the humanitarian self-reliance services initiative of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And now, to the interview. Hi, Ryan, and many thanks for taking time today.
Oh, thank you, Manuel. Appreciate it. Great to be here.
Ryan, Tezos has somewhat of an adventurous history, to say the least. And in this conversation, I don't want to dive into every single detail. I'll put links in the notes of this episode for those who don't know the story and want to read up on it. But today, I'd like to dive more into your personal journey in all of this. So let's perhaps begin with how you got to become president of the Tezos Foundation.
Sure. So I most recently was an executive at a fintech company in Salt Lake City, Utah. And during that time, I had a colleague who introduced me to all things blockchain. So this colleague had been involved in Bitcoin for years and then was involved in Ethereum since the beginning. And so he introduced me to blockchain technology and all things crypto and was just fascinated by the technology. And so I spent a lot of nights, a lot of weekends, a lot of time really looking into the technology and grew more and more excited about it. As mentioned before in the intro, I worked for a few years in the humanitarian space globally, trying to find ways to help the poor, to help lift them out of poverty, examining the best ways to do that and really implementing that. And I love that work.
Where was that? Where did you do that?
You know, it was all over. So Central America, South America, you know, Mexico, Africa, India, you know, globally. So I was centered or located there primarily in Salt Lake City, but had the opportunity to travel a decent amount, but also to analyze and research ways to better help the poor, and then what others would help as well implement in the field. And so it was a great effort. I loved being involved with it. One thing that's always discouraging, though, in the humanitarian space is how do you really scale something that's going to be able to have a huge impact on a large number of people? And as I got involved with blockchain technology, I saw the potential for something that could scale and that could help a lot of people and a lot of people at the margin, at the margins of society.
One question there. When you say blockchain technology, you mean Bitcoin, right?
Bitcoin was the first version of the technology, right? Mm-hmm. And so I think
that
there's
was
been
your
a lot
entry
of
point, Bitcoin.
Bitcoin, Ethereum, and a lot of different projects. So yes, I think that the whole spectrum, though. I came after and learned about this technology after Bitcoin and Ethereum had already started. So that whole kind of realm was encompassed in my knowledge and my learning about what it was. But I really see something as that's immutable, that's transparent, that over time is accessible to all, that's not governed by a central authority, as being something that would be very powerful to help the people that live in places where those types of power structures keep them down. Things aren't immutable. Things aren't transparent. Things are frequently abused maybe by a central authority. And so I see blockchain as an escape and a way to really leverage technology to help a lot of people. And so that got me really excited about it. And also the technology. I just love technology. I'm not a developer. I sort of wish I was. I've been involved in business for years, but have a real excitement for and a desire to learn about all things tech. So
I just wanted to ask, you have more of a management background,
Sure. Yes. I worked for about 10 years in the healthcare industry as an executive and a turnaround specialist, would help take on distressed businesses, businesses that were not working, and helped to turn them around. And during that time period, I also co-founded a software company and later sold those businesses, decided I want to do something totally different. I want to do something where I'm directly helping somebody. And I'm not just running a business or selling something or whatever it is, but I'm directly helping someone who needs it, and someone that maybe if I don't help them, they're not going to get the help otherwise. And so that's why I jumped into the humanitarian space for roughly 2 years, and then back to that fintech company and back to technology where I learned about blockchain. And so I had this friend that introduced me to the technology, read a ton, learned a lot about it, and he also introduced me to this project called Tezos. And looked at the website, looked at the white paper, and was really, really excited about it. And excited about it because back in 2014, the founder, Arthur Brightman, was able to accurately foresee the problems that would be affecting the blockchain space in the future. And not only foresee them, but to actively work on solutions to solve those problems. Problems around a more sustainable consensus algorithm. Problems around security of smart contracts, problems around governance and how do you govern something or decide the future of something that's decentralized. And so I was really excited about Arthur's foresight to not only see those problems, but to design solutions around them. And then when it came around to the spring and summer of 2017, I was excited to contribute to the fundraiser, because not only did they have great solutions to relevant problems, but a lot of people don't realize that the Tezos project, it was not just a white paper. It was an actual functioning alpha net or test net even before the donation period. So it had something functioning that could work. As a member of the community, you could actually be involved with the network and interact with it. And so all of those things combined, I was really excited about it. I contributed to the donation period in 2017. Really excited about it, involved in a lot of the online communities. Tezos has a fantastic community, amazing people from all over the world. So was very involved with that. And then, like everyone else, became concerned when it came to the fall of last year. And we learned about the, I'll call it paralysis, dysfunction, whatever you want to call it, of the Tezos Foundation. And was concerned because I cared, along with many others, about the technology deeply and felt like it could really provide solutions to relevant problems and have a good chance of changing the world in a lot of positive ways.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned this paralysis, and I know that's been talked about so much already many, many times.
Sure.
But let's just briefly, like in just a few sentences, summarize what the hang-up was there.
Sure. I don't know, honestly, a lot of the details in regards to it, because I simply wasn't around back then at the foundation. I really was just a normal contributor to this project, to the fundraiser. And
how did you learn about the issues that happened?
I think probably some sort of news article came out, and so I learned about it, and which is always disheartening because, you know, there's so much information in different sides to a story, but you're just learning something maybe from a headline or something that was really superficial. But basic summary is there was a dispute between the head of the foundation and the founders of the project. Resources were not being used to be able to fund the project. And that was the primary concern of the community. We wanted to see the technology go live. We wanted to see the light of day. And it just wasn't happening.
And you wanted information about what happens.
You know, maybe some information, but we knew that there was a dispute. To me, honestly, I wasn't too interested in learning or even diving into who was right or wrong, or even the details of what was happening. I was more concerned about how do we get out of this? How do we move things forward? And so the focus was always, at least my focus was, we want to make sure that the voice of the community is heard. So you have a foundation, you have, you know, the founders of the project. What does the community think and feel? And we really wanted to see the technology see the light of day. And so I helped to launch an effort to, we had a petition that we put online, launched an effort to start a petition to make sure that the voice of the community was heard in all that was happening. The petition was ultimately signed by, I believe it was roughly 2,000 people from over 95 countries. And it was really exciting. For me, the exciting part was just seeing people from literally all over the world come forward and sign this petition and say, hey, I want to make sure my voice is heard. I'm part of this Tezos community. I care about it deeply, this project, and I want to see it succeed. It was amazing how dispersed it was.
But at that point, you were a member like everybody else of the community.
Absolutely. So it's back in November, and then the petition launched the first part of December 2017. So I was just in, I worked a lot of nights because I was still working at a fintech company as an executive during the day. But at night, my wife, she's a saint in all of this, was very supportive, but would really be working around the clock at nights to catch up and help in this effort. So no, I was not an official part of anything to do with Tezos. I was I guess you could say official, because honestly, Tezos really is all about the Tezos community, and everybody is a part of that community. So in that capacity, but not any official capacity with the foundation or any of that sort of thing. So that was the first part of December of 2017, and the petition started to be signed by people all over the globe. And we realized that we needed to make sure, or I realized, I had a lot of executive management experience, had been on boards, that it's great to have a petition that's signed by disparate people from all over the internet, from all over, but we needed to make sure that it had weight.
Let me just ask you, I mean, you said you launched a petition. I mean, with a blockchain project like Tezos, how did you go about launching that petition?
You know, it was really interesting. It was really a grassroots effort. So we had people from all over the world with different talents, some more with communication, others with web design, others with back-end database experience, and all of it combined to be able to make sure we had an appropriate message for a petition, to make sure that we could host it appropriately, that people could have access to it, that we would be able to track the locations of where people were signing and allow them to tell us, you know, where they were from via their GeoIP location. And it was a great opportunity to see how the community was able to come together in an organic grassroots type of way to solve a real world problem. So it was a pretty organic effort. And honestly, initially, I was happy that we got a few signatures and was concerned, you know, come on, everybody. We had organized this petition, but we cared deeply and we wanted it to be a success. And a few people started to sign, then a few others, and then just an avalanche of people coming forward and really wanting their voices to be heard.
Mm-hmm. But it was really one of the first times I felt that, you know, a community of a blockchain project really mobilized in a governance or around a governance issue.
Yes, I think so. In this sort of way, definitely. In this sort of way, to make sure that the foundation that was supposed to be using the funds for its intended purpose was able to hear the voice of a community that mobilized in a specific way like this. I think you're right. I haven't heard of another case like this. It's pretty unique. And to be a part of it was, I just felt fortunate to be a part of it and saw an opportunity to help. We realized that we wanted to make sure that the petition had weight. And so from my past experience, I knew that it was important that we do that. And once again, my wife is awesome. So I said, honey, you know, I really feel like we need to help out with Tezos, and to do more, we need to start sending money to a Swiss attorney, and he can represent the voice of the community to the supervisory authority, the authority that oversees foundations here in Switzerland. And she was awesome. She's like, hey, you know, if you feel strongly about it, go ahead. You know, let's do this.
Let me ask one more question about that. I mean, you said you were very convinced about Tezos as a project. Sure. And that's why you wanted to help, you know, clear up that kind of, you know, roadblock that happened there that stalled the project, basically.
Sure.
So your conviction in the project, how did that come about?
I think some of it was already mentioned. So I think that this experience of having worked with trying to help the poor, but always feeling like there's so many more people to help, and seeing blockchain as a leveraged way to do that. Studying the protocol itself and seeing that there were solutions to problems that were really apparent in the space. It was Arthur and Kathleen Brightman as well. I saw in Arthur somebody who was able to foresee things that would happen in the industry and provide great solutions, but also somebody different than others. I noticed at this time in the summer of 2017, there was so much hype, and it was terrible. You'd have people trying to hype all sorts of different projects, just having some sort of paper, asking for donations and contributions just based on that, or crazy ideas, or really just about the promotion of themselves, and frankly, of just getting wealthy rather than really focused on the technology and being serious about it. So I saw in Arthur and Kathleen this focus on the technology itself. Mm-hmm. Look, you know, they already had something that was up and functioning before the donation period. I was on the online channels when people would ask, hey, should I contribute or this or that? And they'd always say, if you have any doubt, don't contribute. You know, don't contribute or send any funds if you have any concerns. It was the opposite of what everyone else was doing. And I love that contrarian view. I love people doing something different than the norm, especially when the norm seemed to be so out of touch and out of reality at the time. So that's something that really appealed to me as well. I think another thing that appealed to me is that they had a lot of connections with a real world business. Kathleen was a consultant before, and Arthur had worked for Google, and I believe Goldman Sachs and other places. They had a lot of interactions and prior interactions with real world institutions and businesses. This was something that was not only an exciting technology project, but the vision that I could see or hear was that Tezos would seek to integrate or would seek to connect the technology with real world application and with real world meaning without all of the unnecessary hype. And so that's what a combination of that. I think as I got more involved in the community, I just realized just how awesome they were as well. That this idea that people from all over the world, from so many different countries, surely speaking so many languages, and everyone doing their best to communicate, often, you know, in English. But just how amazing every person was, and with their unique talents, how people were coming together. And so that got me excited. And I got excited too when I saw a community willing to work together to solve the problems that were occurring, to come together, that it wasn't people that were just involved in any old project who just, you know, were flippers or whatever it is. But these were people that deeply cared about the technology. And when a crisis came, they're like, hey, we're going to do something about this. We want to help rather than just running away or doing something else. So all of those things combined to just get me really excited to the point where I just felt like I could help somehow. I didn't know quite how. At that point, as I was mentioning before, it was, okay, I'm going to start sending some funds to a Swiss attorney. And I sent a decent chunk of part of savings to do that. And of just for me personally, from my wife and I. And I did it gladly because I really, really cared about this project. And so helped to fund that effort. And then we realized as a community that still funds were not flowing from the foundation to the development of this project. And so we started to contemplate actually, how could we start to receive donations or all contribute ourselves to help fund the developers? What people don't realize as well is though there was dysfunction at the foundation, this paralysis, the developers and even the founders as well are amazing in all of this. So they stayed heads down, kept on working on the project. The development kept on going. The pace might have been disrupted a bit, but they kept on going, which is incredible. There was so much uncertainty during that period of time that they were heads down. It was amazing. So part of as just caring about the project, also in recognition of what they were doing, we wanted to help fund what was happening. But then we realized shortly that there was an even more critical thing that needed to happen, that we needed to make sure, because the development was continuing to progress heroically, but we needed to make sure that there was a safe place for the network to launch. That ultimately, if the foundation was not able to get itself into a state to be able to fulfill its mandate, that there we needed to make sure there was at least another foundation that was able to be a safe place for the network to launch. So we launched the T2 Foundation.
Right.
So this was an alternate Swiss foundation. Mm-hmm. And really, the focus was not adversarial. The focus was, hey, if the first foundation can get its act together, great. But if not, we have to do this so that there's some place for this network to launch. Mm-hmm. And go ahead.
One question there. Basically, you created a second foundation.
Yeah.
And again, right before we spoke about how this is sort of a premiere of a community around the project.
Yeah.
So how did you come up with this approach, you know, to start a new foundation, have this approach with the Swiss lawyers and all that? I mean, was there any experience from your management work that you did before that you know, flowed into this, or how did you develop this approach?
Honestly, I think it was more simple than that. If Foundation A is not able to do it, Foundation B is going to have to do it. You know, I'd like to say that I was some sort of genius, but I'm not. This was out of necessity, you know, and being scrappy as a community and saying, hey, ultimately, we want this thing to launch and we're going to have another foundation do it if the first can't. And so for the T2 Foundation, there was a great board that was recruited for that foundation. And the key focus, though, was to not rehash or get stuck in the past, but really the purpose of the foundation is to be a safe place for the network to launch if the Tezos Foundation was not able to do so, and really keep that focus forward-looking. I think that focus on trying to find a way forward rather than getting stuck in the emotional past helped me to be some sort of intermediary, I guess, trusted intermediary to help solve the project that I really, at my core, wanted to see the technology go live, was so impressed by the work that the developers were doing, and somehow became this person to help solve the dysfunction that was happening there. I had never planned on being president of the Tezos Foundation. It's not an ambition that I ever had. I have no desire to do that. In fact, I'm more of a person that likes to get things done, but I'm not like things, recognition, ego to me doesn't really matter much. I just like to see things succeed and hopefully be a part of that as well. Money and wealth doesn't excite me that much. I mean, in as much as I'm grateful to have enough to support my family and hopefully to help other people when I can, but we're happy and we're content. More important for me is doing something that I'm passionate about, that I care about. So being the president of the Tezos Foundation wasn't something on my radar at all, and not something necessarily that I desired. But as well, I deeply cared about the project, a proud member of the Tezos community, and I think that each member of the community has a way that they can help, and this happened to be the way that I could help. I was in this particular time at this place and happened to have maybe some experience and skills that allowed me to help in solving the dysfunction that was happening, and so I became president of the Tezos Foundation. I remember...
Well, you stuck your neck out. I think, you know, while many people were just angry on Reddit, you actually did something. That was always my impression.
You know, generally, I think that's something that is great about the community and that will continue to further and develop as we go along, is that it's easy to sit back and be a critic. And it's easy to sit back when we don't have all the information about something or just to demand this or that or to be a critic and say, why isn't something this way? It's not so easy, but it's so much more valuable to stand up for something that you believe in, but to do something about it. So if you're concerned about this or that, is to help find solutions for it or to help further the Tezos network. There's so many critics online and on social media that I think being a community of builders, if we focus on that, that's really a healthy place to be. Mm-hmm. But
did it ever get to you, this criticism? Because you personally were also criticized.
Sure. Yeah, I get criticized a lot online. Honestly, I don't blame people. That a lot of times people don't have a lot of the information. So we're making more of an effort to be communicative, but it was a tremendous... So when I took over in February, it was a heavy, heavy load. And it was a load that is bigger probably. There's probably only a few people in the world that will ever realize the magnitude of the load that there was. And a lot of things that people don't know about as far as just there was a lot to be done. And everything has gone well, and I'm really pleased. But those are things that people don't see. And so maybe they're saying things or making judgments based on a lack of information or not having all the information. But generally...
What do they don't see? most people that criticize?
Sure. I think that when I got into the foundation, there weren't any big surprises. Like, I've had people ask, oh, so is there any money, you know, there left? Like, is all the crypto gone? I'm like, well, of course it's there. You know, like there were no big surprises, but literally there was a state of paralysis. Like, there was dysfunction. Like, it's not that the wrong things were done. It was nothing was done, right? That there was, it had been stalled for a long time. And so just the amount of effort just to get things in place, to get us to a state where we could effectively fulfill our mandate was a heavy lift, and it required a lot of focus, and things went well, but that generally is what I would say in regards to that subject. And so, you know, when I came on board, let's see, in February, I remember, so it was a meeting, and I think this might have been spoken about, and there's this Wired article that came out a while ago talking about the situation, and which is nice on this podcast because the Wired article ends right as the dysfunction stopped, and it doesn't tell the rest of the story, which is so important. But there was this meeting that was really long, and at the end of that meeting, I was made president of the Tezos Foundation, and Mr. Giever stepped down from that role. And it was late at night. It was something like 12:30. A fellow board member gave me a ride back to Zurich. I was staying near the airport, so it's really late. It's like 2 or 3 in the morning. I finally call my wife and I said, "Well, you know, surprise! I'm Tezos. I'm president of the Tezos Foundation, and you know, and we're moving to Switzerland." And so we talked about that. She's been tremendous, and so grateful for her support.
But was that a surprise for you?
You know, we thought, because we're involved in the T2 Foundation, that if the T2 Foundation launched the network, that we could end up in Switzerland. But had no, I did not think that I would be president of the Tezos Foundation as we went through this process, and didn't know if we'd ever, you know, if we would ever live in Switzerland, didn't know if this T2 Foundation effort would be necessary or if ultimately the foundation would get its act together.
What kind of solution did you imagine before? You know, when you launched a petition, when you launched the T2 Foundation, I mean, you must have thought of some possible outcome other than you being the president.
Yeah, honestly, I thought that things would resolve themselves, that people would see that there are also other people affected by this. There's a larger community. They care deeply about the about the protocol, about the network. And I thought that things would calm down and there would be some sort of solution that would come out of it. That didn't happen. And ultimately was a part of the solution that happened.
How did that decision come about? You know, were there people sitting around a table saying, let's make Ryan president? That's the most obvious solution, or what happened there?
Sure. You know, what I can say is that it was remarkably kind of uneventful. It was, okay, let's figure a way out of this, and it would just was thought that potentially I could be someone to help the foundation overcome its dysfunction. Once again, it wasn't something that I walked into some situation was like, okay, you know, secretly I have in the back of my mind that somehow I'm going to be president of the Tezos Foundation. I didn't have it on the radar, and it was not something that I really aspired to at all. But ended up as president, you know, that night, called my wife, and we talked about it, said it would have to come soon. I have, you know, a wife and three kids, three great kids, so a boy and then two girls. And so we talked about it. Of course, we didn't tell the kids initially. We had to make one of those parent-to-parent decisions. And we said, okay, you know, we're going to do this, because I jumped on a flight a few hours later back to Salt Lake City. And it was announced while I was in the air that I'd become president of the Tezos Foundation. But I wanted to make sure that I could tell people to represent in that first initial communication that I would be moving as soon as possible to Switzerland, to Zug. And for several reasons. Number one, to make sure that the foundation never got into this dysfunctional state that it was in before, to show that, hey, the president of the foundation is going to be in Zug, and I'm going to personally make sure that it gets on the right track going forward. But also to show that, look, Tezos is located in Zug, and we're grateful to Zug and the ecosystem here in Switzerland, and we're a proud member of the ecosystem. And I thought the best way to do that was to be here in person. And so I remember as parents when we told our son that we were moving, and of course there were all sorts of tears. He was not excited about it. But my wife, she's brilliant. So she had bought him this Swiss pocket knife, and she just like had it in reserve to be able to use for just this moment. And she's like, you know, I'm really sorry. You know, I'm sure it's really hard for you to process this that we're moving to Switzerland, but I did get you a present. You know, here's a Swiss pocket knife. And so he looked at the pocket knife and he's like, huh. It was like maybe at least 10 or 15 seconds worth of silence. And he just kind of contemplated it, looked at the Swiss logo and looked at the knife. And he was like, wow, you mean to tell me that these things are made in Switzerland? We're like, yeah, absolutely. And so he's like, man, Switzerland must be a pretty cool place then. Oh, okay. And so it was really neat. From that point forward, he started to have a better outlook about coming to Switzerland. And of course, we have, you know, like certain rules, like we supervise him as he uses this knife, so all the people listening, sure. Don't worry, we're like basically responsible parents. But that helped with him. And then we started to watch we watched a couple of videos with the family on mm-hmm. Switzerland and the mm-hmm. mountains and everything. And we lived in Salt Lake City near the mountains, so it's somewhat similar. And and really started the preparations to come. We had to move pretty quickly, and because I wanted to be here on the ground in Switzerland. We initially were in temporary housing, actually, here in Zug, right by the train station. And it was we walked into this place and we just literally brought our suitcases because we're like, okay, let's get there as soon as we can. So walked into the place and learned it was an old, it was a converted dentist's office. So it used to be a dentist's office made into temporary housing. So we walked in and it had this receptionist desk, you know, and everything. And the rooms for us and for the kids had been converted from a doctor's office into rooms. But it was funny because for the first night, I couldn't figure out how to turn the lights on, at least in the main area of the apartment. And you had to go behind the receptionist desk and push the buttons back there and it would actually make the lights go on in the apartment. But no, I remember that first night, and then the next day it was my daughter's birthday, and so we went. There's this shopping mall called Metalli mm-hmm. here in Zug, so we went by the Metalli and
just
got
around
this,
the corner.
Yeah, just around the corner from here, and got this little birthday cake for her, and we went and sat out on the lake just over here in Zug on the dock that kind of juts out from the lake. And that was our first kind of night and first day here in Zug.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. I mean, there's all these stories about Zug and Crypto Valley, like they like to brand themselves.
Yeah.
And sometimes I wonder, you know, what people maybe, you know, living in America or living in Asia feel like Zug will be when they arrive here. And always I have this, you know, impression that they will be terribly underwhelmed when they actually
Okay, how would I describe Zug? Okay, for my family and I, we love it. It's been great. It's a place that I feel like has everything that you need as far as shopping and things like that. It's got space though. It's a little bit, it's definitely family friendly, but also if you don't have a family, it's great. They've got all the conveniences and other things that you'd want if you're single or whatever. But no, I love it here. I've had tours at different places here, kind of hubs. Mm-hmm. Up here, there's different co-working spaces and different things that are dedicated to blockchain. So that's really cool. Yeah, I once spoke with somebody who had recently got off, I think it was the train to meet with me here in Zug, and they had envisioned in their mind that there would be all this like posters, you know, all along the walls in the train station of like Bitcoin and all sorts of different cryptocurrencies. And no, you know, that's not the case when you get off. But there's definitely a lot of people, you know, gathering here. I would say everyone's been really friendly and really inviting. And it's a great place. So we made it here and started with the family, got the kids involved in school, and then the work began.
Got to work on Tezos.
Yeah.
And that was in February.
Well, so February is when I was announced that I'd be president of the foundation, and that happened. We actually moved to the first part of April. So not to say that then the work started, because it was crazy. I was working all hours. I mean, really since December, though, whether I was president of the Tezos Foundation or not, I was putting an incredible amount of time into this, into Tezos itself.
What did you work with in Zug specifically? I mean, was there a team? Were the Brightmans here as well? Or how did you do this?
Arthur and Kathleen, no, they were not here in Zug. There was myself and, you know, really a lot of it was just working through some basic operational things and to make sure we could get resources flowing to the development team as quickly as possible. So a lot of the focus was there in Paris, because the development team is based in Paris. So I traveled quite a bit to and from Paris just to make sure. I first of all wanted them to know that we just appreciated and were so supportive of the developers and grateful as a community and also as the president of the foundation for their efforts. And so spent time there just thanking them, being supportive, and then getting resources flowing. And really that goes to part of the focus. So we're not about the hype, we're about the technology, right? And really coming into the foundation, we wanted to get ourselves into a state where we could be supportive as quickly as possible to the developers and to also have a foundation that did not get back into this difficult state that it was in before. So one of the first things that we did was expand the board from 3 to 7 members. And so we have a full complement of 7 board members, very reputable, from senior researchers to the first female computer scientist to receive a master's degree here in Switzerland, to just great people in the business and VC space, accounting space. Olaf Carlson, over, I think the largest, I'm pretty sure it's the largest, VC firm in the space, out at Polychain, but just a great board. So we made sure that we had a fantastic board initially. And then also we're focused on the technology, that none of this matters unless you ship the technology. And so it was heads down, let's have a laser-like focus and really get this network launched, right? And so we made an announcement that we would launch in Q2 of 2018, and we launched with like 3 or 4 hours to spare. So it was this tremendous, tremendous effort. Just to make sure. Another thing that's really unique about Tezos that people don't realize is a lot of projects, they launch with just some very minimal basic functionality, or a lot of the tokens out there, they're a very simple basic ERC-20 tokens built on top of Ethereum that really didn't take much coding at all to produce, but then they have this token, right? And then at least for a protocol layer blockchain, which is a base layer blockchain, which we are, the work is in actually building this network, right, that you're going to have permanently. And some projects have taken an approach where they have these lofty goals down the road, but then they're going to launch something really not anything close to the ultimate product, but just something that's out there that allows a token to go back and forth or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. And then they'll kind of progress and slowly over years or whatever it is, have more functionality. But we really had this great vision and this great project that Arthur had derived or come from from the white paper. And the beta net phase of the network launched on June 30th, but it's fully functional. I mean, it's a really revolutionary piece of software out of the gate. So a lot of people don't realize that. And it took a tremendous amount of time and energy. Mm-hmm. A lot of people ask about communication. Hey, why wasn't there a lot more communication? Mm-hmm. Yeah, we would have rather had more during this time. And really we had to stay focused on the technology, because we could communicate, all over the place, and a lot of projects, will just have a lot of hype and a lot of statements, but at the end of the day, it's the technology that needed to ship, and we had to have this focus on that so we could meet the deadline. So that was a key focus. Another key focus was to make sure that we were that we are accountable as a foundation, and to do things a little bit differently. So we are the first large-scale blockchain project to bring on a Big Four auditor as the external auditor of a foundation. And we did that just to show that, hey, look, we are really doing things, we feel in the right way, being accountable, being responsible, and we welcome that sort of scrutiny and that sort of external auditing function by a Big Four. So that's been a big effort. And another effort has been to really define more clearly the role of the foundation. And it's really important that this project stay, and that it stays decentralized. And that the foundation really, it's one part of a larger community. And I think it's so cool, as representative of that, the foundation president was just a normal member of the community. But the foundation is one part of a larger community that is made up of researchers, scientists, developers, enthusiasts, literally from all over the world. And sure, we do have a unique role. So we've been given these resources to be able to use them wisely to help further the network. So we want to be accountable for that. And we've announced several weeks before the launch of the network that we would start this grant-making process. And we see that as the primary means by which we can use the funds to be able to support the network and allow for researchers and scientists and people from all over to be able to receive grants, to be able to further the Tezos network. So that was another key effort. And then we launched the network, and it's been remarkably smooth. I've been so impressed by the development effort that's gone into this and with how smooth things have gone. And some people have asked, what is going on with Tezos? I haven't heard about them for a while. They haven't been in the headlines. And the reason is because we've been getting a lot of stuff done. We've been focused on delivering. And I think as well, sometimes the media gravitates towards some sort of sensational story.
Well, not just sometimes.
All the time, right? And so there's really not a sensational headline. Like, we are delivering on the software. We're really excited. The community is expanding and growing. We're continually launching grants. We've got exciting people that are inquiring about interacting with the Tezos network to build applications. And so, so that's kind of where we've been, where we came from, and where we're going.
Ryan, we now covered a lot of your journey into becoming the president of the foundation.
Sure.
In of how you untangled that mess, so to speak, mm-hmm. how you shipped, right? How you went live, sure. with the protocol, and also how you reorganized some of the governance and the processes mm-hmm. in the foundation. And you said before that it was much, much more work than maybe you thought before, and that was visible from the outside. Was there ever a point where you weren't really sure that this is going to happen?
That is a great question. You know, there were a lot of times, just to be totally honest, that were really hard. It was a heavy, heavy lift. And I was grateful to be able to help, but it was a heavy lift, and it was a big disruption to life, you know, to my wife, to my kids, to the family. And then that combined with the heavy load, it was intense. It was difficult. I think generally, maybe the analogy that I like to use is, I think that we all go through really hard things in life though, right? I mean, whether it be on a personal level, whether it be with a business or an entity or a society, and there's, life can be great and life can be really hard, right? But when you have something that you're doing that you think is really worthwhile and you believe in that, that obviously helps a lot, is reminding yourself of that. But I think any great success has gone through a period of a lot of adversity, right? And I look at the community and how galvanized they were, how hard everyone pushed to help overcome this adversity. I just see the developers and them continuing forward when there was so much uncertainty, and then the founders as well, just the tremendous grit it's taken to do all this, that I think there's one perspective to look back at what occurred and to look at it as this tragedy. But I choose to see it in a different way, that we can't always control what happens to us in life, but we can control our reactions and how we face the adversity. And everything that's successful goes through times that are really hard. And I think people become successful in part because they've gone through something really hard and they've pushed through it. You know, they've had to overcome some significant adversity. And so I see the Tezos project as being a lot stronger for it. People ask me sometimes, how is this on-chain governance thing really going to work? And I say, well, you know, there's a lot to be sorted out. We're going to have a basic on-chain governance and we'll move forward. But there will be a lot of coordination and different things that will have to be worked through. But look, this community solved a really difficult off-chain problem and did that successfully, that I really think we'll be able to figure it out, this on-chain governance. And maybe not in spite of all that's happened, but because of it. You know, we'll be able to find more and more success because we've gone through difficult things. And when things are hard again, or when we have to find solutions to hard problems, we're capable of doing that, you know, as a group, as a community. So, hard, but yes, worth it, and grateful for everybody else that's been mm-hmm. involved. Mm-hmm.
Would you say the issues that existed with Tezos are solved? or is it still an ongoing process?
Yeah, no, it's great. So what people don't realize is we expanded the board. The board is phenomenal. We've been working, firing on all cylinders since March of last year and moving forward. There's just a lot to do. Launching a state-of-the-art project like this is really, really hard. That's why few people in the world have done it successfully. And this, Tezos is not... the code base, it's not a copy of something else. A lot of the projects are a fork of something else, a copy of something else. This is written from the ground up in a functional programming language. I'll talk a little bit more about that later, but it's really, really hard to be able to do that. It's using a novel consensus algorithm and on-chain governance. There's a lot of features to it that are really revolutionary, and it combines a lot of those. So it's a really hard thing to accomplish, and it's hats off to everybody who's been involved. Mm-hmm.
You personally, what was your main learning from this experience?
Let's take a quick break for a message from our sponsors. This episode has support from no official sponsor, but from my very own, the Blockchain and Us newsletter. Get an email from me every 2 weeks with a very short summary of new podcast episodes so you can immediately pick those interviews you'd like to listen to. To stay up to date, just visit www.theblockchainandus.com and sign up today.
What was your main learning from this experience?
You know, I think it goes back to a couple of things. I think that you need to care about something deeply. And you need to do what you think is right and make hard decisions and move forward. And there's always going to be a critic and always somebody that's going to say that you're terrible or that you're doing things wrong. There's a lot more of that, I think, now than there used to be, even because of the nature of things online and on social media as of late. You know, a lot of shouting, a lot of anger, a lot of people oftentimes do things when they're distant, maybe online or anonymous online, that they wouldn't do in person. And so you have to have conviction that you're doing the right thing and that you have the right motives and just move forward.
Let's speak about something else. I mean, I did some research, obviously, before this interview, and I read that you brought Prince Constantine of the Netherlands together with Tezos in some way.
Well, it was crazy. So I was just getting started with the Tezos Foundation. I think this was like baptism by fire. Like, I was just getting involved, and this was maybe more of what to expect. Is I had been asked by somebody here locally in Zouk to give a little bit of a 5-10 minute presentation on some boat that would be going across Lake Zug. Apparently, Prince Constantine, the Dutch delegation, was going to be coming into town to talk about blockchain technology. So I'm all new, you know, at the foundation or new in this role, and said, great, you know, this is an opportunity to really give back to Zug, right? And really contribute, say, yes, the Tezos Foundation is here. And of course, we'd love to help. So I get on this boat and I give like this 5-10 minute, just like a little speech about Tezos, was really excited about it. And then this picture goes online, some sort of tweet goes out with a picture of me, you know, speaking on this boat cruise with Prince Constantine close by, and everybody is, you know, sipping champagne and everything. And, and everyone's like, oh, well, Ryan doesn't even work. He's too good for everybody now. He's on some boat, you know, sipping champagne, not even paying attention. Or there might be some sort of like rumor that somehow Prince Constantine is now like a Tezos community member or something. No, like the truth of it is I wanted to give back to the local community, and I got asked to do this. So I'm like, great. You know, I'm a member of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, AKA a Mormon. We actually don't even drink alcohol. So like, I don't even drink alcohol. Of course I wasn't sipping champagne on a boat. But anyway, so this tweet goes out there and I'm like, oh, okay. My life it's a little bit different now. That some sort of picture that's taken can be taken totally out of context, or something that I say, or something that I don't say, or something that I communicate or don't communicate is going to be seen in many different ways. And it was maybe a rude awakening to a little bit instructive to me on just how life would be.
Got it.
And once again, I'm not someone, I don't mind if it's to help further the cause of Tezos to speak, but I'm not one that seeks the spotlight. Like, it doesn't excite me to be a focus of attention. And so it's just interesting how motives and things can be misconstrued, but that's part of the territory. And it's hard to differentiate. You know, some people are, there's all sorts of different types of community members, and some, I think debate and even criticism is fine. You know, healthy debate and healthy criticism, but there's people with all sorts of different motives. And then some people who just purely want to tear down and find fault. And I like to think that generally the Tezos community is a community of builders and is a positive community. And so that's been mostly my experience.
Okay, cool. So what is maybe... you know, and a piece of advice you'd give somebody who may find him or herself in a similar situation where all of a sudden, you know, they had to step up to a more public role and have to find out how to deal with it?
That's a great question. I would say a few things. I would say that I think that there's do what you think is right. And stick to that, and make sure your motives are good, and be humble and try and take criticism, you know, from others. That people can be critical, but one approach is just to reject it. Another approach is to say, hey, you know, maybe I can learn something from that, and maybe I can find some sort of kernel of truth, you know, that can be used to improve. But I think generally, inside of each one of us, we have this a little bit of a compass, right? And we kind of know in our gut when something is right, and we do our research, and we do our kind of deliberation, and we do all that we can to prepare for something and make a decision. But we know, and we feel like when something's right, it's right, and go for it. And it doesn't mean it's going to be easy. And sometimes you're standing up, and you're the focus of criticism or you know that sort of thing. But if you do what you think is right and really have pure motives, that things end up working out. Not always in the exact way that you had anticipated, but things work out. I'm a firm believer in that.
Mm-hmm. Cool. In your work at Tezos, and maybe also before as an entrepreneur in your projects, do you have any role models?
Any role models? I think I'd probably, maybe I would answer the question a little bit differently in the form of characteristics, because I have a lot of people that I look up to for various reasons. And I really appreciate people who take the time to understand others. I appreciate people who can execute, who can get things done, who can think critically through things, put a tremendous amount of desire and passion into something. I appreciate people who also are kind. I appreciate people that are humble. And I think there's some basic leadership principles that those are things that I really look up to people. And there's a lot of them that have those different traits. And those are the things that are most important to me. Hopefully over time, I can make sure that I have some of those. But that's generally things that I appreciate. Yeah.
When you grew up, did you always want to be an entrepreneur or, you know, in a function where you could decide how things are done?
Yeah. You know, so my dad was an entrepreneur and he's a great, great man. But I think from that, like I both was excited by entrepreneurship and terrified by it at the same time, you know, because it's so exciting and you get to do new things. And that's such a part of me. But also you see that it's really, really hard. And it takes a lot of grit and things never work out as you think they're going to. And it takes just a lot of effort and problem solve. And so I think doing things that are creative, doing things that take a lot of effort, solving problems particularly, I'd love to fix things. I love to solve problems. Like that is just so fulfilling to me to be a part of a solution to a problem. I really like that. So in as much as that's part of any entrepreneurship project, I really like that. But no, I think I've had the typical love-hate relationship, right, with entrepreneurship that most people have had. And but yeah, so I think that was... I really liked to learn and to do new things. And so for me, that's really exciting, is doing something different. Mm-hmm.
What are you currently learning?
What am I currently learning? Balance. So I gave, you know, 6 months, 7 months just of life almost entirely to Tezos, which I'm glad to do, but it's taken such an amount of time and energy. morning, daytime, night, middle of the night, morning, and that was okay for a turnaround phase and to be able to get Tezos on the right track. But I love my family dearly, and they are the most important thing to me. And so it's, there are seasons of life, I think, where we go through times that take extraordinary effort, but it's focusing on the things that matter most. And it's not that I'm going to be less diligent as far as Tezos. I'm really excited about it. We're on a great trajectory and the future is bright, and we'll continue to see, I think, accelerated improvement and a lot of exciting things. But it's having that balance and making sure that I give appropriate time to those things that matter the most to me, you know, to my wife and to my kids, so that I develop that relationship. And I think we can do all those things. But it's just this process of balance. It's like keeping, twirling plates, you know, balanced on our fingers and maybe on our feet, and trying to keep them all up at the same time. And so sometimes you have to twirl one faster and then kind of keep the other one going and focus on that. But so it's a little bit of work in progress, but I really love my family deeply. And so I think balance is what I'm learning now. And I think we're doing good.
Mm-hmm. Cool. I mean, I find this fascinating because I'm probably one of the least balanced people.
I should interview you. In what way?
Well, yeah. I mean, I sometimes find it very easy to do one thing.
Sure.
200%. Oh, and yeah. To forget everything else.
You know, and that's similar for me, is I really like to jump into something and dive into it and just give everything I have, you know, and solve a problem and be passionate about it. And that's has been and what Tezos is for me, but it can be done with balance. And that now is a season of balance, but while not leaving anything undone, and of course, still moving ahead at great speed. But yeah, I think that's something that I'm learning, and life is exciting. You know, there's always new phases where you learn different things. And well, it seems like every day or every week, there's a new learning, but that's the exciting part of life. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Cool. Let's speak a little bit more about, you know, the technology of Tezos, of blockchain technology,
sure.
And also, you know, about maybe its part in the future.
Sure.
Let's imagine, I mean, you said it before, you said you see blockchain and Tezos in particular as one of the building blocks of some, you know, maybe let's call it some kind of blockchain future. Sure. If, let's say, all of this happens, all of this pans out the way it's intended to by you know, the inventors who build these protocols, how would you describe this kind of future that we'll see maybe 5-10 years down the road?
Now that's a great question. And let me answer it starting a little bit differently, explaining exactly what Tezos is and then how I see Tezos being a part of that future. So there's been some incredible innovations. I would start first with Bitcoin, which the innovation is incredible to me. And I call that blockchain 1.0. This idea that you can exchange or transfer value without an intermediary is a really, really powerful idea and innovation. And just the fact that it's been running for over 9 years now, and it's still up and going, and it still hasn't had, you know, any major compromises as far as security, it still works, is incredible to me. And I think I'm just in awe by that kind of core innovation that was Bitcoin and blockchain. And then comes along Ethereum, which incredible, the innovation there. And I call that blockchain 2.0, or this idea that you can transfer value, right, between parties without an intermediary. But you could do so while using this idea of a smart contract, right? That you can embed more code and logic into the value being transferred. So let's say that I'm going to transfer some value, something from point A to point B. But if C happens, then I split it and I send it to parties D and E. And just that logic, and then the more complex logic that can be built around that sort of transfer of value, to me is incredible. And I see blockchain as this internet of value, meaning that now we have this ability to transfer value without an intermediary. And the types, I'm excited for the types of things that will come from that. Now I see Tezos as on a leading edge of innovation within the blockchain space, and I would consider it a blockchain 3.0. And I would say that for three reasons. Number one is the proof of stake algorithm. So each blockchain, for those who are not very familiar with the technology, has a consensus algorithm. And that is the method by which all of the different people on this network come to a consensus or agreement on who owns what, or what they call the state of the ledger. And so previously what's been used is this consensus algorithm called proof of work. So this is the idea that one is going to use a computing power to be able to decide who gets to help participate in coming to consensus on the network and really securing or validating the transactions on that network. So
often called mining.
Yeah, mining. Yep, exactly. So what's grown out of that is that you have these really large banks of mining computers in different areas of the world, some areas more concentrated than others, that use, last time I checked, it was something like the energy consumption of the entire country of Ireland or something like that.
Bigger countries.
Yeah, I know, right? And see, these massive amounts of energy to be able to secure the network. So Tezos has a different way to come to consensus on the state of the ledger. It has a different consensus algorithm. So it uses proof of stake. And what that means is instead of using work or electricity or energy to be able to participate in this process, this validation of the network, the stakeholders, the people that own Tezos tokens, are able to contribute to this process. So you don't have these miners or these banks of computers. You have, in Tezos, we call them bakers.
But I was always wondering why it was called bakers. I mean, in many other protocols, it's called stakers, staking. Here it's called bakers.
Yeah, it was done before I got to the foundation. So the explanation that I've been told is that it harkens maybe back to its French roots. And it is a, didn't want to use the word forging because that also has negative connotations. And maybe minting is too close to mining. And so what could we use? Well, it's baking. You know, that could be a great idea for it. So that process is called baking in the Tezos ecosystem. And what that means is that Tezos token holders can participate in the validation of the network. And how that works is if I had Tezos tokens, then I'd have to put up a portion of those as a deposit or a bond. So that as I am, and then I'm called on randomly, depending on how many Tezos tokens I have, to be able to help validate the network or validate some of the blocks or transactions that go through the network. So what happens if in basic terms, if I were to do something malicious, then the bond would be slashed, right? And then that is an incentive to keep everybody honest on the network. And so the result of that is instead of having this very energy consumptive process, it's a lot more efficient and it's a lot more sustainable in the long term. And what it does as well is it really aligns the incentives of the different pieces or parts of the network. So currently you have in Bitcoin, you have the developers, right? Maybe in one camp. And then you have the miners who are running these big banks of the computers on the other hand. And then you have the actual token holders maybe in another camp. And they all have this interesting relationship and some of them have different incentives that aren't necessarily aligned. You see, the people that have Bitcoin would probably like transactions fees to not be very high. But I would imagine if I was a miner, I'd say, well, I'd really like those transaction fees to be high, right? Because then I can receive those as a miner. So there's a misalignment sometimes, maybe, as far as incentives and various blockchain solutions. And so with Tezos being proof of stake, you really align those. And you align those by saying that, hey, the people that are actually validating the network are the token holders themselves. And then when they go through that process, which they're randomly called upon to do so, they receive a reward as part of that process. It has been really, really exciting to see how that's worked in the real world. So it started June, the network went live June 30th. The foundation did the baking for the first 7 cycles, and then the decentralization continued or started after that. And the foundation, it bakes. I think it's to a point where parties other than the foundation bake approximately 60% of the network now, and that continues to be more decentralized over time. It's so neat to see, because as a token holder, you can bake yourself and set up a node, but if you're not tech savvy, there's also a secure way to give the rights to bake to a delegate, to another mm-hmm. party, to be able to do that.
How many different parties currently exist that bake on Tezos?
Great question. And the next the most recently scheduled cycle, 411. Yep. So significant.
Do you know where they are?
I've seen a list, and it's all over the place as far as delegates. So there's these services that that advertise that, hey, you could send the right to bake to me, and then I will bake for you, then I'll give you some of the rewards back, right? So I've seen a list of these delegates, and it's really neat to see them from all over the world. As far as the location of all the bakers, I'm not sure if that's available. I'm not sure if that's tracked, but it would be exciting if it was, or to be able to know that information. But generally, you can know where the delegates are from, and it's from all over. So I anticipate that is a very widely distributed process as well.
So there's no concentration, like, for example, in mining, right? I mean, we can just also say openly where most of the miners are, which is in China, because there the chips are cheap and the power is inexpensive.
Yeah, I see no indication of that. And I could even see in the future, though, that the foundation wouldn't even bake. Mm. It would just delegate its tokens to a community member and allow them to do that. And of course, any of the rewards that the foundation receives from whether it's baking itself or it's delegating and gets some rewards back, those go right back into the ecosystem, right? So those go right back into helping further the support of the network and further the Tezos protocol. So that's the first part. The consensus algorithm is really exciting because it to see how quickly these businesses have kind of grown and overnight developed. It's really, really exciting. And there's actually, so we've supported, as far as the grants, one of the grants that we issued was to a company, Obsidian Systems out of New York. And so they're helping with Ledger integration. So, Ledger and Nano S, I'm sure you're familiar with Ledger
hardware wallets.
So the really cool thing is that we actually have, and I'm not sure if any other blockchain uses it in this way. So it's currently the tool is improving, but there's a command line client for for just the basic wallet functionality to use with a Ledger, the integration. But there's also there's also an app for baking. So you can have, I think it's the first time that a hardware wallet, like a Ledger Nano S, has been used, or that specific device, for securing the network, for validating the transactions on a network. Usually it's just, considered kind of a wallet type device where you send and receive funds.
So basically the Tezis that reside on the Ledger, you can stake those or bake with them.
Yeah, you have to have a baking node set up. And so every time that you have to sign a block to validate it. And so it just pings your Ledger. It's done in a very secure way when it needs to sign it, rather than just the typical usage of a Ledger, which is great. And I have to say one thing. A lot of times people call Tezis. And kind of different nomenclature gets thrown around, but I think Tez, generally, I guess who am I to say is any sort of authority, but I think Tez sounds so much better than Tezis.
So you'd like to do away with the term
Tezis. Away with Tezis, yeah. It should be Tez, right? Singular or plural, Tez is great.
Okay.
But anyway, so that's the first innovation. So this proof of stake algorithm, that's gone really well. I've been really excited about that. The second part is this focus on security. So as I mentioned before, Tezos is not a copy or a fork of something else. It's really a new protocol network written from the ground up. And it's written from the ground up in a functional programming language, OCaml, which was developed in France. And a functional programming language is like OCaml are used in a lot of mission critical type infrastructure projects. So you're going to see it in like aerospace, you're going to see it in the transportation industry, like trains and things like that. You'll see it in pharmaceuticals, you'll see it in the financial industry. Mm-hmm. Jane Street uses OCaml. So it's used traditionally for really secure types of applications. So it's written from the ground up in OCaml. And furthermore, the programming language lends itself to this process of formal verification. And so what that means is it's this field of research where you can actually mathematically prove certain properties of a code and that certain code will behave in certain ways as intended. The idea being that as we continue to research in this area, that the Tezos protocol will be a prime target and lend itself more easily to this type of formal verification. So if we wanted to have very high value or mission critical smart contracts on the Tezos platform, this process of formal verification, as it continues to be developed, what it would allow you to do is to say, okay, here's this high-value smart contract. These are the properties that we want to have verified, right? That these certain things are going to happen and that there's no possibility that they're not going to happen. And you could actually verify that sort of thing and mathematically prove it. And I could see services popping up in the future where you could have people that are formally verified different contracts. You could have mathematical proofs that then are distributed to the different parties, and you know, here's proof that this thing is going to behave as intended. So that's a really exciting innovation. As we've known, there's been smart contracts are a prime target for malicious actors to either steal funds or freeze funds or whatever they're going to do. And so I think written from the ground up in a functional programming language, then also one that lends itself to this process of formal verification, is really exciting. Mm-hmm. The third innovation is also really exciting. It's one of my favorite. So this idea of on-chain governance, right? So we've seen this in protocols where they are decentralized, but then how do you decide the future or coordinate the future direction of something that is decentralized and do so in a way that you can continue to innovate and grow and do so with the speed necessary to stay at the forefront of innovation? And so there's this idea of on-chain governance that there's a clear method built into the protocol by which each token holder has a vote, and they would be able to decide the future of the network. They'd be able to say, this is the direction we want to go. This is the innovation that we want to see, and they'd be able to guide that. What that does is it not only solves this problem, which, you know, currently I think the method of doing that online, right, is just flamethrowing on Twitter. Like you say, no, you know, this should be the future of the protocol, or no, this should be the future of this other protocol. And where you play a game of chicken and say, I'm going to fork, or I'm going to on this date, or no, I'm not, or yes, I am, or whatever. And then maybe there is a fork, maybe there's not, who knows?
Well, let's just say there's no clear on-chain governance currently.
Yeah, and the default method is a lot of shouting and whatnot generally. But I think that there is opportunity for a more coordinated type of on-chain governance, one where everybody has a say. So maybe it's a more true and a more fair way to do it, where every token holder gets to have a say in the future of the network. And so generally that really excites me. But the part that also excites me is how it helps to solve this problem of the tragedy of the commons. So in technology, particularly, there's this problem that manifests itself when you have something in common between a bunch of parties. Who has the incentive to keep that thing up, to really provide the resources to maintain that or to improve it? Mm-hmm. So we see it with...
I mean, and sorry to interrupt there, but an offline equivalent is overfishing.
Sure.
You know, it's you know, the old economics example is, mm-hmm. you know, this meadows that everybody can, you know, send their cows or sheep to, and then, you know, it just gets... you know, trampled down and nobody can use it anymore because it's just been used irresponsibly.
Yes.
And so, of course, there also exist digital commons.
Yes, exactly. And so one of the most famous, the most used is the internet, right? And so with the internet, you have this base layer protocol, which is TCP/IP. And it's the basic way by which information is shared between computers, servers all over the world. And so what's happened is you've had really large businesses come and build very profitable things, and they've kind of pulled the value out of the network, right? So you have the Facebooks and the Googles who have built these very successful businesses on top of it, but there's no incentive to really upgrade or put resources in or to coordinate the improvement of the base layer protocol, right? The pace of innovation at the TCP/IP level is... incredibly slow. Mm-hmm.
Just slow, I think it's non-existent.
Non-existent, yeah. and so...
all the innovation on the internet is not on the base layer, it's on the application layer.
Actually,
right?
Absolutely. It's on the application layer. And so that's why we would call the internet or the base protocol of the internet a thin layer protocol, right? So with Tezos, this also manifests itself in the blockchain space, right? So you have Bitcoin, tremendous innovation. Hats off to the innovation, to whoever whoever created it, we don't know. But hats off to them and all that's been done. But you have this network that has incredible value, but there's not a lot of incentive to improve the base layer protocol. Relatively speaking, for the value that is there, it's a relatively small... a group of people that are working on the base layer protocol, right, of Bitcoin. Similar to Ethereum, You know, incredible innovation there with Ethereum. You know, hats off to them. But the incentive is much greater to build something on top of it or launch an ERC-20 token rather than work on the base layer protocol. And relatively speaking, I would say that I would imagine that the development effort of the base layer is pales in comparison to all the different people that are launching tokens on top of it or just ERC-20s and doing ICOs on top of it, right? And so with Tezos, when you have on-chain governance, it gives you a new and innovative mechanism to solve the tragedy of the commons. And how we do that is we say, okay, let's invite developers from all over the world to think of a problem with Tezos and how we want to improve it and make it better. Bring your idea, create the code, and bring it to the Tezos protocol. Bring it to the protocol, and then we are going to, we can vote on it. We'll put it to a vote. All the token holders get to say, okay, yes, that should be a part of it, or no, that shouldn't. And then the person that brings the innovation, they attach an invoice to the upgrade, right? And if everyone accepts it, then they get paid out in Tezos tokens, creating this potentially massive incentive to be able to contribute to the base layer protocol and not just do like a token on top of it, but to contribute to that base layer. And I would imagine if somebody could build something incredible that could maybe, let's say, they could justify that somehow they're going to increase the value of Tezos by 1%, by a half of a percent. The amount of value that a single developer or a team of developers could demand by bringing that sort of innovation, and if the Tezos community said, "Great, you know, we want that feature, that functionality, that code," it just creates this really interesting, innovative way to be able to have people build at the base layer and create what we would like to think as a fat layer protocol, where the value accumulates mostly in the Tezos protocol itself, while still allowing neat things to be built on top of it. So that's that third innovation that I would say that is there that is really exciting in regards to Tezos. So how does Tezos fit into the wider ecosystem? And what does the world look like in the future? So it's hard to say. I see industries where I say that they're ripe for disruption. So, you know, financial industries, I see insurance industries, you know, different markets, that sort of thing. But I think we're in a phase similar to people have likened the state of the cryptocurrency market, for example, to that of the dot-com bubble, right? That, hey, there's all these ideas and there's this innovation, but most of the stuff, you know, went bust, but some stuff succeeded and it was really, really big. So maybe there's, some powerful similarities between those analogies that have to do with states of the market. But I think that there's also similarities with the state of technology. So with the internet, when we found out that you could exchange information without an intermediary, people were like, wow, you mean you can send an email? Like, that's incredible. We solved like all the world's problems because you can now communicate. You don't have to send letters anymore. Like, amazing, right? Email. Oh, and actually, you don't have to go to the library anymore because there's this online, like, there's online dictionaries and now there's online encyclopedias where you could find out about a lot of things. Like, wow, okay. Amazing innovation, the internet. But nobody could foresee all of what would happen thereafter, right? All of the tremendous things that would be built when you unlock this key ability to transfer information without an intermediary and more freely between any party around the world. And so I see a similar state in blockchain technology. That there's this tremendous potential, right? There's this ability to exchange value without an intermediary. And right now we have a glimpse. We're like, oh, great. That means you could like send value across borders and there's no intermediary. Wow, that's really powerful. Or, okay, great. That means that if you have a failing government, like there's going to be the ability for somebody to have their value in something that's not going to depreciate incredibly like the whatever local currency there is. So there's some of these use cases that are kind of easy pickings that people look to. But I think that we'll see waves of innovation that when you unlock that key potential, I mean, clearly, if you can exchange value without an intermediary, if you can do so in a way that it can embed in computer code and logic into that, there's going to be some tremendously powerful things that are built out of that and that we'll see arise. So I'd like to see in that a future vision of how the world would be or the things that will be built from that, how Tezos would be positioned is, you know, Tezos will... It's the self-amending ledger, right? Meaning that any upgrade that could be, you know, any innovation that's out there can be assimilated into the Tezos network. So for example, when looking at consensus algorithms, so right now there's a lot of research around consensus algorithms, and Tezos, you know, it's been in development for a couple of years. So it's I believe the technology is solid, but there's new research and innovation that's going to come out that's probably going to have, faster, more scalability, faster throughput, get to finality a lot faster, that sort of thing.
Well, maybe new consensus algorithms that we don't even imagine yet.
But imagine this, imagine a world in Tezos where you say, okay, so we've incentivized all these developers around the world. So there are three new cutting edge consensus algorithms around there. And so we're going to spin up a testnet that is consensus algorithm A Tezos, testnet consensus algorithm B Tezos, consensus algorithm C Tezos. And we could literally have those up and running probably before another project even launches that's using those consensus algorithms. And then you simply go to the community and you say, okay, which one do you want? Let's have a vote. And then you could integrate that into the Tezos protocol. And because it's built in a modular fashion, it's much easier to take components and bring them in. And you could really actually swap out a consensus algorithm. You know, that's possible. So I see the pace of innovation being fast with Tezos, and really I don't see it, because it's self-amending, there's no limits, right? You can always take in the latest innovation and have that become a part of the protocol.
With self-amending, you mean this on-chain governance mechanism?
Yeah, exactly. The self-amending meaning that the community votes on future innovations or current innovations they want to bring into the protocol, and then all the nodes hot sync, they automatically update with the latest version of Tezos that the community has decided upon. And the blockchain continues forward. I mean, that idea is really, really powerful. And you could do that with all sorts of aspects, not just the consensus algorithm. And so I see Tezos as being at the forefront of innovation and not having limits as far as innovation and being able to do so really quickly because of that mechanism. I see it as being a platform when people want to build things that are secure. Generally that they would say, okay, you know, what types of computer programs lend themselves to that sort of security that we're looking for in the future, which one is moving in the direction of a formal verification and it's going to have those capabilities first. Those are the types of things that I'm excited for as far as Tezos. I think when you look at, in the end of the day, a blockchain is almost like a jurisdiction, right? So you're going to have So people come to Switzerland often because it's this place where, you know, there's peace, things don't go from side to side. There's not radical swings in what's happening with the country. It's a pretty mm-hmm. stable environment. Mm-hmm. So businesses would come to Switzerland because they're like, hey, I want a place that's peaceful, where there's a stable environment, where there's, that sort of thing, where I can be confident in the current and the future state of where I'm going to be. I think blockchains will increasingly become more like that. You know, if a big company is going to want to build up on a blockchain, if a government's going to want to build an application or a solution on top of a blockchain, they're going to want to go somewhere where they know that, hey, the future, like there's a mechanism by which you decide the future of this thing. It's going to be something that's on the cutting edge of innovation, and it's going to be a place that's stable. And it's going to be a place that's governed well, that has a community that's proved that it can govern. So I think those types of things excite me and give Tezos a unique prospect for the future.
Mm-hmm. Cool. I mean, you described a lot of the technical aspects of the features, so to speak, of Tezos, and also some of the, you know, of the applications you mentioned, financial applications. But what are maybe applications that you see Tezos play a big part in that fulfill maybe that original promise that you mentioned at the very beginning of our conversation, where you said, let's hope that maybe people who are less fortunate can also, you know, participate in the wealth of the world, can trade. What would be applications of Tezos in this regard?
Sure. So look at Africa, for example. So Africa, tremendous penetration as far as mobile phone technology, increasingly smartphones as well. And you could potentially look at people storing a value on their phone in a secure way without need of any sort of intermediary. You could potentially have people participate in the validation of the Tezos network from their phone. and help to stake the network. I mean, be a part of this global community to provide the security of the Tezos network right from their phone. You could potentially have them, you know, family members overseas or in different places. You could also, they could provide value back and forth without an intermediary. But beyond that, I see all sorts of, you know, applications that will be developed as far as being able to provide transparency, being able to provide immutability in societies where that's not always the case, where when it comes to value, and smart contracts playing a key part of that, of whether it's insurance markets or other markets or whatever it may be, or lending markets, providing a means by which that's done in a transparent yet a secure a secure way, but done in a way where it doesn't rely on this kind of local intermediary that maybe has or has not done what they're supposed to in the past.
Those are still mainly financial use cases, though,
sure,
that you mentioned here. You know, insurance, remittances, and all that. What are maybe more use cases that we can't currently so easily grasp?
Sure, sure. You know, I would say a couple others. So these are pretty general. So there's been talk about property rights and things like that, where in different places, in different countries, it's unclear as to who owns the property, and it's very difficult to get a clean title or appropriate title to something. So I think being able to track who owns what at a particular point of time could be something, generally a powerful thing that the technology could bring in a developing economy. Identity probably is another big one, and then others as they come down the road. Yeah, I think the key for us is to unlock a base layer protocol that has the ability to track the developers, it has the properties that they're looking for to build things on top of. And I wouldn't pretend to know all of the things that they're going to build with it, but we know that the technology is powerful and they will come, and I'm confident in that. That when the right technology is there and the right ability to provide solutions to people in various areas with these powerful properties, that they will come. Generally, I would say that there's a good amount of interest and excitement around Tezos.
Cool. We spoke a lot about solutions, right, that blockchain technology can bring, and ideas for positive change.
Sure.
But we mentioned the internet before, and of course, the internet had also many, you know, maybe less intended consequences,
sure,
to put it nicely.
Yeah.
So do you sometimes worry maybe about certain things that blockchain technology could unlock that aren't so desirable?
You know, I think that it will be similar to the internet in certain ways, like you've described, where you will have use cases that a lot of positive things and some negative things as well. But I think when you look at the balance of the internet and you look at the positive, the negative, should we not have an internet because there's a negative? I mean, does it on net provide a positive to society? I would say, yeah. Yeah, that it does, that it provides a positive to society. I think it will be the same. I think it will be the same way as far as this new technology, that there's going to be some great things that can be done with it. There's going to be some not so great things done with it. But I think at the end of the day, it'll be a net positive for societies and for peoples. I think generally that's why it's important for the people creating this technology as well as those people using it, of just doing our best to be responsible actors in the space. Generally, there's two things about the current state of the space that concern me. So I would say one is the hype, that there's too much hype and there needs to be more of a focus on the technology. What are we delivering on the technology? And then at the end of the day, let's connect the technology to real world applications. I would say the second thing that concerns me is the centralization that I see in decentralized, you know, projects or
centralization.
I would say that things like that appear almost like big businesses to be running decentralized networks, right? Mm-hmm. And at the end of the day, the foundation, we are being really deliberate about staying true to decentralization and to defining what we really are in the ecosystem, that we are one member of a larger Tezos community. we're not. There's no control or central authority figure in the Tezos network. Nobody, no single entity controls, right, or manages Tezos. It's a community effort. It's a decentralized effort. And what that means is that we have researchers and developers and computer scientists, enthusiasts all over the world that matter, that can get involved. How that informs the decision-making of the foundation is the following. So before I got to the foundation, it was considered that there would be this veto power over the network for the first year. And I think it was done just to make sure that things were, you know, security, kind of safety net for the first while of the network. Well, the new board, as we got in, this idea of decentralization is really important to us. And so we are not having any sort of veto power of the network. It should be the community that decides the future of the network throughout the life of the network. So another thing that informs is this strategy of grant-making process, that really what the foundation will be doing is providing grants to all different aspects of the Tezos community to where they can do their own effort and their own work to help further the Tezos protocol. And what that means is we're not going to have this centralized authority that is controlling the effort, right? There's not a centralized authority that does all the marketing, that does listing on exchanges, that decides the future of the network. That's everybody, the wider Tezos community decides the future of the network. It's not the foundation. So those are some things that we are being deliberate about staying true to. Even this baking that I described earlier. So the foundation is baking roughly 40% of the network. That will continue to decrease over time as more bakers come online. But as well, we'll end up most likely in the future delegating tokens to other people to be able to bake to further help decentralize things. And like I said, any rewards received will be used right back towards the community. So those are some of the things that we're doing to position ourselves, I believe, well, and that's the current focus of the foundation.
One thing I also wanted to ask is, I mean, we spoke obviously about Tezos mainly here.
Sure.
But you know, how is the conversation with other networks, for example, Cosmos, Definity, even Ethereum? You know, how are the bridges between those different communities?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So I generally think that there's a lot more ways to collaborate than we do. And there's too much of tribalism generally in the space, but I can only speak from personal experience. So we gave a grant. One of the latest grantees was a group, Cryptium Labs. They're actually based here in Zug. The developers, two of them actively work on the Cosmos network, and another one worked for them before. They run a delegate service, but they're also doing a lot of other things for the Tezos network. They're going to do a lot of kind of documentation, community building, and helping people to understand what Tezos is all about and have the resources to interact with the Tezos network. So that's great. I mean, that's here locally in Zug. It's actually people that code on another protocol, but are working on Tezos as well. Cosmos is proof of stake and Tezos is proof of stake. So they're excited to be involved with Tezos as well. So I've had the chance to meet with them, had the chance to meet with somebody from Web3, from the Polkadot group the other day. But generally, I think that there's opportunities just to at least be decent to each other. I mean, there's obviously going to be some healthy competition among various projects, but there's a lot more that we have in common that we could better communicate on and exchange ideas and be respectful, you know, in our deliberations and debate. Healthy debate is awesome, but I think a lot of it could be brought to a higher level, particularly online. And maybe that starts with interacting with some people in person or face-to-face.
Okay, great. If you had one wish to change anything you'd like, maybe in the world, what would that be?
You know, I'm a weird guy where I walk down the street and sometimes my wife probably gets annoyed, but inequality bothers me of this idea that that some have a lot and some have a little, and there's not a way that everybody can just have enough and be happy and have more. And I think one wish would be a world that's more that's more fair, that's more equal. We're still people, you know, work and are ambitious, but where people have more opportunity all over the world, not just in certain locations. And that would be my wish.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Do you think you'll still be working with blockchain technology in 5 years?
Oh, that's a great question. You know, my life takes so many interesting, crazy turns, but I'm grateful to be a part of Tezos and to help it to move forward. So I don't know what the future is going to be in 5 years, but it will be somewhere where I feel like I can contribute, where I can provide value and do something that I'm passionate about.
Mm-hmm. Great. Excellent. Well, I mean, this was really fascinating. And I was just sitting there absorbing the information. So we could have gone on many of these topics much deeper.
Yeah.
But I really appreciate your insight and your openness. Sure. And thanks a lot for this conversation.
Yeah. No, thank you very much, Manuel. I'm humbled that you would, take the time to speak with me and we could do this together. And thank you for the opportunity. Appreciate it.
Thanks so much for joining us today. More info on our guests and our sponsors is in the show notes of this episode and on the podcast website, theblockchainandus.com. To help people find this podcast, it's important that you download, subscribe, and give it a top rating and review on iTunes or on the podcast platform of your choice. I'm Manuel Staggers, and I thank you very much for listening.